opportunity to hear argument in Roy Disney versus Walt Disney.
May it please the court, it's my pleasure to reintroduce to the court Mr. Paul Rowe of the Wachtell Lipton firm.
Welcome, Mr. Rowe.
He has been admitted for the purposes of the proceeding and will make the argument with the court's permission. Also with me at counsel table are my partner Don Wolf and Mr. Robin Wall, also of the Wachtell Lipton firm.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Sparks.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Before I start the clock, the court just has a preliminary question that maybe you can address and Mr. Rowe can also address. In light of the purpose of the underlying proceeding, the court wants to make sure that we're not hearing a matter that's become moot, and because of any change in the executive composition of Disney management, and also make sure that none of the documents in dispute here became public information during any recent litigation.
Let me address those in order. First place, it's not moot. My client continues to be concerned about the compensation regime and processes at the Walt Disney Company. The compensation committee chair, Ms. Estrin, who was the chair at the time these matters first came to the Chancery Court's attention, continues to be the chair. My client continues to wage his campaign for better corporate governance at the Walt Disney Company. Your honors can verify that if you wish by checking on the SaveDisney.com website, which continues to be maintained for that purpose. And my client has publicly indicated his unease with Mr. Iger's succession to Mr. Disney, and that is also reflected in that website. As to the second question that Your Honor's raised, I believe, and I'd have to confirm this, that one of the documents, and it is the letter from Mr. Gold to the compensation committee. Appendix, I can pull that out if Your Honor's need me to. I believe that may have been a document that was marked at a deposition and hence became public in the sense that it's buried in the file of the other Walt Disney case pending before the chancellor. It was not marked, to my knowledge, as an exhibit by either side in the case, and so it's not in that level of prominence. But I believe that one document may be public in the sense that theoretically, if somebody really went and dug around in the bowels of the Register and Chancery in Sussex County, they might be able to find it. But we have not sought, given the process of this, to take advantage of that or to view whatever happened in that as in effect releasing that single document from would Your Honor want to have Mr. Rowe respond?
Did you want to respond at this time, Mr. Rowe? Do you agree or have anything to add to that?
I have nothing to add about, we're not in the case pending in front of the chancellor, so I don't have anything to add to Mr. By that I mean my firm. I have no personal knowledge.
But you're representing the company, so you don't have any knowledge that these documents in dispute have become public.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, very well. Thank you.
With Your Honor's permission, then I will turn to my argument. My client, Roy Disney, as Your Honors are aware, based on those questions, is waging an ongoing campaign for better corporate governance at the Walt Disney Company. He, together with his family, is the company's largest individual shareholder, and as part of that campaign to further it, he made the Section 220 demand that we're here about today. And the purpose of that demand was, and I quote, because it is of issue here, was, quote, to investigate possible mismanagement, waste of corporate assets, improper influence or conduct, improper conflicts of interest, and lack of due care, close quote, concerning the company's executive compensation processes, which the company had and has repeatedly touted as being based upon best corporate governance practices. The purpose was not limited to filing derivative or other litigation. The demand letter doesn't even mention the concept of litigation. And at the time the demand was made, Mr. Disney simultaneously demanded stockless materials for the purpose of communicating with stockholders. Now, when the company refused to produce the books and records absent an agreement by Mr. Disney to a confidentiality agreement that would designate all non-public information as confidential, Mr. Disney went ahead and filed a 220 suit. And in his complaint, he specifically averred that the company, by insisting upon unreasonable confidentiality restrictions, was seeking to sterilize his ability to communicate with the company's stockholders. After that, with full knowledge of the intended use of the documents, the company chose not to contest the propriety of Mr. Disney's purpose.
Does he want to communicate to the public as well through the website?
He wants to communicate with stockholders, but the way to do that in this electronic age would be to place portions of these documents on the website.
Well, that's not the only way to do that, is that? You could mail it.
You could mail, but the cost of mailing to Disney's stockholders every time you had anything to say to them is massively prohibited. They have hundreds of thousands of shareholders. It is just can't be done in any practical way. So I think we do have to, you know, it's an appropriate question in terms of the age that we're in and framing and considering all of this. But the reality is that if there's to be communication, there are two forms it can take. It can take one, it can be utilized on the website, or number two, there can be discussions consistent with SEC requirements with, among others, individual institutional investors who are active in the corporate governance area, and which is where much of the action today in terms of disciplining management is taking place, through large stockholders who are interested and willing to speak up.
Could you require password access to the website for certain levels of information?
You could do that. I'm sure technologically that could be done, and that's an interesting possibility if that were something that Your Honors wanted to have done here. They gave the documents with the understanding they produced them, and the other agreement was, since the parties were unable to agree on a definition of confidentiality for these purposes, the company basically taking the position that anything that wasn't public is confidential. And at that point in time, our position was that you ought to be looking at Rule 26, and the gap was not closable. It was decided that the documents would be produced to Mr. Disney. He would have an opportunity to look at them. Perhaps when he looked at them, he would conclude there was nothing in there that was important. There would be no issue, but if there was, the question could be taken to the Court of Chancery.
Well, let's go back to your starting point, and that's the request to get the documents to investigate.
Right.
As I understand your position, if the documents were delivered and they were not confidential, the investigation was a proper purpose, and then once you have these non-confidential documents, you can do whatever you want with them. You can communicate with shareholders, or you can file a suit.
That is correct.
So, to the extent you didn't say you wanted to investigate and communicate with stockholders about the investigation, that just wasn't really important.
That's correct. It's not important. After the company then designated a substantial portion of the documents as confidential, Mr. Disney applied for expedited relief to the court. That's all referred to in Vice Chancellor Lamb's opinion. Ultimately, relief was denied without prejudice to the issue being later submitted to full briefing. In the course of those expedited proceedings, however, the parties came together to the extent of narrowing down the universe of documents to the 10 that are in the appendix and referred to in one of the opening pages of our brief, so Your Honors could find them by page number in the appendix. And while few in number, the documents at issue directly address the reality of the company's compensation practices, and we submit stand in sharp contrast to its public pronouncements about them. Now, following the annual meeting, we had full briefing and argument, and the trial court issued its August 6th opinion. And the only issue presented for the trial court's resolution at that time was whether those 10 documents were confidential, such that Mr. Disney should be prohibited from communicating with other stockholders concerning their contents. And the problem is that the trial court refused to address that question. Instead, it ruled as a matter of general application that Mr. Disney had only two choices. He could litigate a claim for breach of fiduciary duty, or keep silent with respect to the documents. The court held as a matter of law that absent exigent circumstances, books and records, and I quote, and this is at pages 11 and 12, will remain confidential unless the stockholder concludes that grounds exist to initiate litigation and the court in which that proceeding is brought determines to include those documents in the public record. In effect, saying your path is to go file a derivative suit or a class action, even if that's not what you think is the best way to remedy this situation in the future. And as a byproduct of that, you'll then find yourself under a disclosure regime that may permit you to utilize the documents.
Can I stop you right there? Because on page 7 of the opinion, it appears that the court did evaluate whether these documents really are confidential or not, and said that although typically these concerns involve private corporations, it can also involve a public company, and says, in this case, for example, the documents at issue all relate to the private communications among or deliberations of the company's board of directors, letters, emails, and internal memorandum reflecting and relating directly to preliminary deliberations of the company's board. Little doubt that these that the people had a reasonable expectation that they wouldn't be disclosed. Doesn't that amount to a finding that the documents in question are properly designated confidential?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't think so for two reasons. First, it at least appears to me, in terms of that, that what the court is talking about is the characterization.
Is
the characterization that the other side has placed upon the documents. It's not at all clear to me from reviewing the opinion that the court actually went through the exercise of looking at each of the 10 documents separately and asking what's in this document and what is the company's interest in protecting it versus the stockholders' interest in having this information. Secondly, having made that statement, when the court is all said and done in terms of its basis for decision, which appears at pages 11 and 12, it moves to this global concept that does not have within its thinking and logical progression the idea of having to look at the documents. You simply ask yourself the question, has the loss, you say, did the stockholder sue based on mismanagement? Has he or she or it brought a lawsuit? If the answer to that question is no, the inquiry is over. And that's what he says he did in terms of the basis for reaching his decision. And that contradicts the Sato case in this court. That finds no support in Section 220, and it is bad policy. And for all of those reasons, we think this case ought to be reversed. And let me talk briefly. Sato. Your Honors are familiar with that. I'm not going to go back through the facts. In fact, Your Honor wrote the opinion. And that's a case in which the court says where a 220 claim is based upon alleged corporate wrongdoing and assuming the allegation is meritorious, the stockholder should be given enough information to effectively address the problem, either through derivative litigation or through direct contact with the corporation's directors and or stockholders. And then went on to say, stockholders are not limited to using information about corporate mismanagement to institute derivative litigation, but may also seek an audience with the board to discuss proposed reforms. Failing in that, they may prepare a stockholder resolution for the next annual meeting or mount a proxy fight to elect new directors. And contrary to that case, the lower court ruling proceeds on the incorrect premise that the only permissible use of mismanagement information gleaned from 220 is the commencement of litigation, and erroneously, therefore, imposes this litigator keeps silent limitation on all stockholders who would utilize 220. Now, recognizing the absence of any statutory support for that rule, the company in its answering brief runs away from the lower court's opinion, devoting much of its brief to arguing that the opinion did not impose such a rule and that the vice chancellor did in fact exercise discretion. And that argument simply can't stand in the face of what is said at pages 11 and 12. Because it was decided on the basis of a legal ruling of general application, no document by document balancing is shown on the opinion, even in the section that Your Honor speaks of. And there's no balancing of Mr. Disney's interest as a stockholder versus the company's interest in secrecy. And so no discretion was exercised, and the scope of review here is de novo. Second, it's bad policy. Why is it bad policy? Well, it promotes a policy that's antithetical to what this court spoke of in Liquid Audio, where it said the ideological underpinnings upon which the legitimacy of the directors managerial power rests is the franchise. And the lower court assumed without any basis that board secrecy is going to promote good corporate governance and effectively held that stockholders should be forced to the courthouse steps rather than to the ballot box, or rather than through putting pressure on management to change its ways through the type of pressure that can be put on by large groups of stockholders getting together and saying, we want change. There's just nothing to commend a policy that promotes secrecy on executive compensation decisions. Directors are not the company. They are the elected representatives of the stockholders. And the lower court's decision, by assuming that secrecy is a goal in and of itself, effectively would insulate all directors from stockholder oversight, even in the sensitive area of executive compensation, which is one of these agency areas where greater oversight, as Blasius teaches us, is necessary, and even where a suspicion of mismanagement sufficient to support a Section 220 demand exists.
How would you propose to really protect confidential documents? If they're going to be disclosed and shared with other shareholders, and somebody else decides to give it to the media, I mean, isn't this really going to be a fishbowl?
No. And the reason is that there is a middle ground between Rule 26 on the one hand and everything that's private and confidential on the other. And that is the way this ought to work. And your honors have an opportunity to fashion this and provide guidance to the bar and to the courts below in this case, even in the unusual posture it comes up in. And that is that confidentiality orders ought to say, and they ought to be entered in these cases, they ought to say, one, if it violates Rule 26, it doesn't have to be produced. Number two, if it deals with personal information, Social Security numbers, telephone numbers, that type of information, it doesn't have to be produced. And number three, if it is harmful to the corporation's business or financial interests, it doesn't have to be produced. And what does that leave? Well, that leaves that if it doesn't meet any of those criteria but is simply potentially might give rise to criticism of the agents, of the directors or the officers, that's not a basis for excluding it, and it's certainly not a basis for excluding it simply because it's private, which is the position that the company staked out, simply because it hasn't been publicly filed.
Well, let me go a little bit further along the same lines. Let's assume that one of the documents that's currently in dispute is some director's notes of a meeting where they were talking about how much they ought to pay a particular person for the position that they were going to hire him for, the position he was already in. And the notes include, oh, well, this person does a little bit too much drinking, or this person had some problems at his prior job with inability to relate well to women or minorities, or, you know, and just, you know, you can assume whatever you want, right. but it'd be that kind of a set of comments written down, which on the one hand, you know, certainly could have relevance in terms of establishing what level of care the directors exercise in reviewing potential officers. On the other hand, that's certainly pretty confidential information.
And I think that would be excluded under what I just laid out. I think that's going to be a personal business evaluation as distinguished from an indication of the process that was gone through among the directors. And I mean, because of the information that we're
a personnel
asking.
Matter?
Same thing for a personnel matter. I don't believe in, certainly none of the information that's included in the appendix that we seek to put out deals with anything like that. Indeed, we've been criticized for redacting such information sort of on a darned if you do, darned if you don't basis. If you redact it, you make it turn it into snippets is what the other side has said. Well, that type of information we think is appropriately not included. Let me just touch on one other matter. I see my yellow light is on, and I can come back to what seems important in the 5 minutes I reserve for rebuttal. It'll probably be three when I'm done. One other response to the fishbowl argument, and that is, this case is unusual in the sense that having conceded the propriety of the demand, we get to a later stage than you normally get in one of these cases. But I think it's appropriate for the court to think about the bigger picture. The idea that it's going to chill the boardroom is a red herring. Why? Well, first, you've gotten the protection of the type of confidentiality order that I would suggest become the practice here in terms of a standard. Secondly, you never get to any of this unless first there's been a reasonable suspicion of mismanagement stated under Section 220, and second, that the particular documents that are being sought under a 220 law are deemed necessary in order to address that particular purpose. So all of that is a red herring. We're not trying to upset any balance here. But the position that the company has staked out is unrealistic, inappropriate, and not really right for this court, which ought to be respecting the right of directors to talk to directors, but also respecting the right of stockholders to talk to stockholders in a Delaware corporation. And I'm going to sit down and save my last 3 minutes at this point, unless your honors have any other questions of me at this time.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Paul Rowe for the Walt Disney Company. Listening to Mr. Sparks, I'm not quite sure which of the various positions that I think I heard him espouse on behalf of his clients to respond to first. Some of the time, I think Mr. Sparks is arguing for what he calls the middle ground, which seems to be a look at specific documents and a determination of an appropriate confidentiality order. And my response to that would be, that's exactly what happened here. That's exactly what the Vice Chancellor did. He heard the parties on three separate occasions. He read reams of briefs. The documents were presented to him. As I think Justice Berger mentioned, there's language in the opinion which, at least in our view, can only be read as a finding that his view was the documents are actually confidential. He then, as is his power under Section 220, exercised his discretion to craft relief, which was to say that as to these 10 documents, in the form they were presented to him, he would maintain confidentiality protection. And he observed, and this is totally consistent with existing law, he observed that the plaintiffs, or the petitioners, Mr. Disney, would get a second bite at the apple should they choose to sue. That is clearly true, because if they bring a lawsuit, the strictures of Rule 26C, rather than the general discretion conferred by Section 220, would have to guide the discretion of the Court of Chancery.
Can I interrupt for a second? It's certainly not a requirement that I know of, but frequently the Court of Chancery, in dealing with a books and records issue similar to this, will actually go through and say, number one, the X document or the X group of documents, which are all minutes of an executive committee meeting, you know, and then a description of what the court is going to do with respect to those documents, and then go on through either individual or categories of documents. You say that the court, in essence, did that here, but am I just supposed to accept that that's what happened? How do I know that that's what the court did?
Well, the court says that, first of all, we only had 10 right. documents constituting 34 pages. It wasn't a situation where there was a room full of documents. We had produced things like the minutes without a designation of confidentiality. But in this case, unlike some 220 cases, we went further and produced emails and preliminary exchanges of views. And as to some of those, we claim confidentiality. And the court on page 7, in the language that Your Honor called attention to, said, in this case, for example, the documents at issue all relate to the private communications among or deliberations of the company's board of directors. And then they include letters, emails, and an internal memorandum, as well as an excerpt from minutes of a meeting of the company's comp committee and a fragment of an attachment thereto, et cetera. I think it's clear from his opinion, although he didn't refer, and I would concede this, to them on a Bates number by Bates number basis, that he looked at these as a type of document, because they pretty much, after the process we went through of reviewing the documents for production and designation, they were a category of documents. They were documents relating to this preliminary consideration by the board. So yes, we do think that it's clear from the opinion, as well as from the record, that the court reviewed the documents.
Okay, well, if I'm not as comfortable as you are that that set of sentences means the court actually reviewed the documents, can you show me something in that you say the record also supports the idea that the court actually looked at these documents and made an analysis of their level of confidentiality?
Well, I think only that in the opinion, he goes on to say that there is little doubt that those who participated in the communications had a reasonable expectation they would remain private unless disclosed in the course of litigation or pursuant to some other legal requirement. So that I would say that by making that finding that there was a reasonable expectation of privacy or protection, he was engaging in the classic judicial function of characterizing the documents based on his review of them. I think part of the problem is that just as Mr. Spark's presentation to this court was about 50% about the specifics of these documents in this case, and the other 50% was about things of much more general abstract application, such as the importance of the franchise and so forth, those arguments were made below, arguments, policy arguments. And because policy arguments and arguments about how 220 proceedings should generally be handled were made below, the Court of Chancery addressed itself to some of those arguments and responded to the position being taken by Roy Disney. And I'd like to address some of those policy arguments now, because I do think that Mr. Sparks is really trying to have it both ways, and in essence to paper over what could be a very dangerous situation if in fact his proposed broad rule is accepted. Because while on the one hand we heard him say there's a middle ground, I also heard him say that essentially corporations have no interest in confidentiality of these sorts of documents, and that there is no threat of a fishbowl environment or of chilling of directorial candor. And I have to say that we completely disagree with all of those conclusions. If boards of directors of Delaware corporations feel that every piece of paper on which their thoughts are recorded, every piece of paper that they receive or that they send to other members of the board, not in the final act when they take corporate action, but as they're exchanging views, and it may not even be things that apply to an individual's reputation, but it might just be to an individual's performance, for example, at a prior company, a prior job. Or it might be an attempt to be candid about the performance of one of the company's divisions. Or it might be an honest disagreement about a business policy. If all it takes is for a petitioner under Section 220, who I think we would all agree has to meet a relatively light burden in getting to first base, if those documents are producible under 220, and that might vary from case to case depending on the purpose and the scope, but once those documents are produced in a Section 220 proceeding, even if they're just given to shareholders, if there are hundreds of thousands of shareholders, I think it's inevitable whether they're posted on a website or not, they become part of the public domain. And so there's nothing secret in the boardroom. This is not going to help individual companies. It's not going to help shareholder welfare. And I dare say it's not what is intended when this court speaks about the importance of the franchise. The franchise is, of course, very important, but it was never intended that in the course of a proxy fight, the contestant who is attempting to unseat the board essentially have, through Section 220, a roving commission to go through the files upon a mere suspicion of some sort of impropriety, and to then argue about individual statements made by directors in the course of what should be frank and candid discussion. And the same way, and I make this suggestion with some trepidation, but the same way that I think that a collegial court with more than one judge or justice on it would find its deliberations to be chilled in some way if the records of those deliberations were available to litigants or to the public at large, I think that in most cases, directors would find their deliberations and their frank evaluation in the employment area of the company's executives to be chilled. And as the court below said, there is a specific harm. The specific harm that this Vice Chancellor found in this case was quite specific. It was that the particular documents in the form being proposed to be disclosed were documents that would require the board to either sit by and allow Mr. Disney to tell the world what his interpretation was of a director or a consultant statement, or it would have to go public with its own side of the story. There would be a cascade of additional information. And the end result, with whatever good intentions everyone started out with, the end result would be that issues such as bonus decisions for employees, what sort of financial targets are being set for various plans, these things would all become public. And ask yourself, if you're whoever considering taking a job at a company where your information, if you will, is going to be treated in that respect versus going to another company, doesn't this sort of a rule put public companies at a disadvantage, both to private companies, and it puts public companies that have dissident shareholders at a disadvantage? But neither of those is necessarily decisive. The worst effect I think it has is it does chill the normal discussion inside a boardroom. Now, I'd like to turn for a moment to our view of what the Vice Chancellor did in this particular case, because as we've said in our brief, we think that it's very clear that he gave Mr. Disney full due process, if you will, under Section 220, a full review of Mr. Disney's claims that these documents should be in the record. He heard the application not once, but three times, twice on an expedited basis. To me, the notion that the court below in some way shut the courthouse door to the claim that these documents should be allowed to enter the public domain rings very hollow, because Vice Chancellor Lamb heard that specific argument, again, not once, but three times. And he then made the findings and engaged in the reasoning that we see in his decision of June of last year. Now, when he made his decision, he did take into account facts specific to the case, such as the stated purpose of Roy Disney's demand, which was to investigate potential wrongdoing and not to do any of the other things that they now wish to be able to do with the documents. And among other things, the fact that Mr. Disney, when he was a director, voted in favor of a Walt Disney Company policy which took the position that internal board deliberations in the interests of all the shareholders should be confidential. And we didn't, in effect, come up with this rationale after the fact when there was litigation. There was a board resolution at a time when Mr. Disney was on the board. He voted in favor of it. And of course, it makes sense. It makes sense that when a board meets to consider topics, the board members should be able to think that their deliberations will, outside the litigation context and outside some other context which the court left open for future litigations, that they have an expectation that they are not acting on a public record.
But Roy Disney can't even seek a co-plaintiff, can he, under this confidentiality order?
Co-plaintiffs, Your Honor?
Yes.
Well, if there were, do you mean other 220 applicants?
Well, the Vice Chancellor ruled essentially if there's going to be litigation, you go through that, you file your litigation, and then seek to have the documents released that way. But in terms of making the decision to litigate, which Mr. Sparks indicates his client wants to pursue other avenues, assuming he wants to litigate, he cannot say, hey, join me in this litigation, here's why, to even a single shareholder. Is that right?
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree in the sense that he can make his case, which he's been making very volubly and with what he considers to be considerable force for the last 2 years, he can make the case that there's been mismanagement at Disney or there have been bad business decisions, and he can seek others to join him in a litigation. The one thing he can't do under the order is take these 10 documents and use them, in essence, to say to other potential plaintiffs, and this is a great litigation because of these 10 documents. But he's not prohibited in any general way from communicating about the company or about his concerns for the company.
He could say, I have the smoking gun document here, but I can't tell you what it is. Join me in the litigation.
I suppose he could say that.
Well, wait a second. I'm sorry to interrupt. I thought he doesn't have these documents. That it's not just a matter of whether they're released and able to be used publicly, but I thought he wasn't even given these 10 documents.
No, Your Honor. He has the documents.
Okay.
He's had the documents from the beginning. But there was an agreement that we would be able to designate documents confidential and that designation would be subject to the court's review.
Okay.
And I think if you step back and think about what a Section 220 proceeding is meant to be and what the responsibilities are of a 220 petitioner versus those of a litigant in the typical derivative or class suit, it is clear there is a basis in the law for making the distinction. When a single shareholder, and Mr. Disney has $750 million worth of stock, but the same rights attached to somebody who has $75 worth of stock, when they go in and seek documents, they don't owe responsibilities to anyone. They are basically acting on their own, and the other 99.9% of the economic interest in the company is unrepresented in that proceeding. And so the statute gives to the Court of Chancery plenary jurisdiction to fashion whatever relief the Court of Chancery believes is appropriate, in effect to protect the economic interests of the other shareholders.
Well, let me see if I understand your position generally. If someone demonstrates a proper purpose under 220 and there is no confidentiality, you would agree the shareholder can do anything they want with those documents. They can communicate to other shareholders or they can use them to bring a suit. But if you state a proper purpose and you get the documents, you can do what you want.
I would rather, Your Honor, say that I think that's the practical result rather than that's either the intention or the desirable result. But I think under current law, that is probably the practical result, yes.
All right, so then if we go to the next step, it's you give the documents and they're designated confidential, as in this case. So Mr. Disney got the documents, he can read the documents, he signed a confidentiality agreement, and as I understand your representation of your understanding of the current law, then you can do nothing with them without the court's approval. And in this case, what in essence you're characterizing the vice chancellor as saying is, you got the documents and you got them pursuant to a confidentiality agreement, and in my view you shouldn't be able to use them generally. In the event you decide to litigate, you can renew your request and we'll decide it under Rule 26. But for purposes of disclosure, I'm saying that you can't disclose them.
Your Honor, I think if I'm following you, that what the Vice Chancellor did here was to uphold the reasonableness of the restriction on the use of these particular 10 documents, yes. And that he did so because, as the guardian, if you will, of the absent 95% of the shareholders who aren't in his court and aren't represented by anyone in his court, he felt, making a classic equity judgment, he felt that the risk of harm to the generality of the shareholders, and I don't think he was concerned about the personal interests of the directors. I don't think this is about director power. This is about recognizing the reality that in the Court of Chancery in a 220 proceeding, there is, putting aside the corporation and the directors, there's no one but the court representing the generality.
Characterize them back to my questions. If there's no confidentiality agreement, you demonstrate a proper purpose, you get the documents, as you've indicated, as a practical matter, the shareholder can do what they want. But if you get them pursuant to a confidentiality agreement, then the court has this gatekeeping role. And
I'm virtually out of time, but...
Can you explain how the ruling is consistent with McKesson and specifically the language Mr. Sparks cited from McKesson?
Well, that case did not involve confidentiality per se. It involved scope issues. There's nothing that we think prevents Mr. Disney, for example, from framing a shareholder resolution. It just can't be a shareholder resolution that quotes from the documents. And I don't think that's the way we usually think of shareholder resolutions, that it's important that the shareholder resolution include specific quotes, snippets or not, from documents. Furthermore, there's nothing that prevents Mr. Disney using these documents in communications with board members. If, in the language of that case, if Mr. Disney wants to seek an audience with the board and discuss these documents, there's nothing in the order that prevents that. And nor is there anything in the order that prevents Mr. Disney from either running a proxy contest, which he declined to do this past year, or if he does run a proxy contest, from communicating generally with shareholders. This is a very narrow order tailored to just 10 documents. And we don't think in any way it has an impact on the general ability to serve the general purposes of corporate democracy that are vindicated in that decision.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me turn directly to a couple of the issues that were discussed between the court and Mr. Rowe. First, it is simply bad policy to force lawsuits for past acts when collective stockholder action to prevent recurrence in the future is, in the view of a stockholder, the preferable way to go. What are we about here if we're around telling people to go file derivative suits, even if you don't really think that's the best way to get corporate change, solely so you can have an entree to it, some sort of Rule 26 determination?
Well, Mr. Sparks, let me follow up on that gatekeeping question to see if I understand the difference between your positions. I think we're characterizing the Vice Chancellor's ruling as once something's marked confidential, it stays confidential unless you want to litigate.
That's what he said.
And you would agree, however, that once it's marked confidential, if you want to make it public, you go to the Court of Chancery, and what you're looking for is an item-by-item review.
Only in this case, Your Honor. Only in this case, because what should have happened in this case didn't happen. And that is that normally you would have a confidentiality order entered at the time and as a condition of getting the books and records in the first place. And it would set some standards. And it wouldn't set the standard that anything that's not public is private, or anything the company designates as confidential. It would set a standard, and the reason I went through with Your Honors what standard would probably be appropriate is it would set a standard that's more lenient than Rule 26 and less lenient than this idea more lenient than nothing, if you will, that everything that's private is confidential, and less lenient than Rule 26, in that it would also say if it harms the company, you don't get it. And then we'd have a standard. And we submit, of course, that if that had happened, none of these 10 documents would fall within that court, that category. Because there is none of this type of information that's going to chill anything in these materials.
Or it's the type of
chilling that we ought to be encouraging, not discouraging, because it's directors trying to hide behind processes that aren't appropriate at the same time they're saying that they are.
Well, how does the court distinguish between what you don't get and what you do get, but you don't disclose?
If it's not confidential, you can disclose it. There's no disagreement on that. If it is confidential, you can disclose it if it's outside. You can't disclose it if it's confidential within the meaning of either this court's ruling in this case, when either it or the court below looks at the documents, or in the context of what I would hope would be future cases. And what normally happens in the Court of Chancery is there is a confidentiality order entered at the time of production. It has standards. And if those standards if the company asserts confidentiality under those standards and they aren't challenged, it can't be used, except through court action in a litigation. But we're not in that posture.
Thank you.
Here. I have just a couple of other quick points.
Unfortunately, your time's up.
I'll be done. Thank you.
I think we'd appreciate your arguments. Thank you both very much. The court will adjourn briefly and take this matter under consideration.